Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Robin Proud. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I've been a member of Prairie for, amazingly, over 20 years now, and I am currently on the program committee. Welcome to this morning, a beautiful morning, and this opportunity to be together in community, which is a time of joy, comfort, and sometimes challenges. This Unitarian Universalist congregation is a place where we come to learn more about being human. We're not here because we figured out life's questions or because we think we've got it right. We come here to learn more about being in relationship together, how to listen, how to forgive, how to be vulnerable, and how to create trust and compassion in one another. Our chalice lighting today is just a short phrase by Fanny Farmer, who I'll be talking about. Cooking may be as much a means of self-expression as any of the arts. So I will be giving the presentation today. I was asked by the cookbook committee to speak. Yes, sir. A while ago, Carlene approached me on behalf of the cookbook committee. And so many of you know that I have done a series of programs on Unitarian Universalist women. Sometimes I call it famous women we've barely heard of. And in many cases, we know the name but nothing about them. So I mentioned it to my brother, who was very well-read and excellent at trivia. He was even on College Bowl, if anyone remembers that show. But he said, "Was she a real person?" Now, that's understandable because, for instance, Betty Crocker is not, and you notice she changes her looks over the years, but Fanny Farmer was a real person, a Unitarian, and someone who revolutionized the world of cooking. But I found there wasn't a lot of information on her own life. However, I happen to have read some other materials that overlap with this subject, so I'll talk a bit about cooking in the U.S. in her time, about her life and work, and about ties between domestic science and suffrage. I used several books for the talk. This one is called Women in the Kitchen, 12 Essential Cookbook Writers Who Defined the Way We Eat from 1661 to Today, and it has a section on Fanny Farmer. There's Perfection Salad, Women in Cooking at the Turn of the Century by Laura Shapiro, and All Stirred Up, Suffrage Cookbooks, Food, and the Battle for Women's Right to Vote by Laura Cuban. And they're all readable, popular histories. And all of them have some recipes along with modern adaptations. If you think about it, in the 18th and 19th centuries in America, for instance, the job of housewife involved being a nurse, a teacher, a laundress, which was a lot of work when you had to fetch and heat all the water and scrub everything by hand. You would also be a maid of all work and, of course, a cook. Now, some of those activities were done seasonally or weekly. Laundry day was famously on Monday. But cooking and the related preparations and cleaning up had to be done three times a day. And of course, cooking included baking all the breads, and it also often included making food for the ill. It also could make your own medicine, soaps, everything else. People regularly lived in extended families or had servants or hired hands, so there could easily be a dozen people at each meal. And of course, there were no modern appliances. Food had to be kept cool in cellars. Cooking was done over an open fire or on a cast iron stove. There were no temperature adjustments. To test the temperature of the oven, you were supposed to stick in your hand and count how long it took until the heat forced you to take it out. You had to place the items on the stove at the right distance from the flame to achieve the correct results. Now, it's a bit like this in barbecuing, right? You have to be careful where you put this. And recipes, if they existed at all in print form, only gave a list of the ingredients or said things like, a lump of butter the size of your thumb. There were several well-known cookbook writers in the first half of the 19th century, and one was Lydia Maria Child, who's someone I talked about in the past. She was much more than a cook. She was a fervent abolitionist, and she wrote the first comprehensive nonfiction book about slavery. She also wrote on history, religion, and care of the sick. And she wrote a novel with an interracial marriage between a Penobscot Indian and a white woman. She founded, edited, and wrote for a hugely popular children's magazine where she published her famous poem, Over the River and Through the Woods. She never had much money, and whatever she made was lost in the quixotic schemes of her husband. He had great ideas, but they never came off. So when she published a cookbook, it was called The Frugal Housewife. While other books at the time designed for homemakers included tips on managing servants and holding luncheon parties, hers had chapters entitled Common Pies and Cheap Cakes. At the age of 62, Lydia compiled a list of her employments for the year of 1864. They included numerous writings, correspondence, and charitable works. The list ended with, cooked 360 dinners, cooked 362 breakfasts. It seems she got to eat somewhere else a few times in the year. And I would guess that she cooked breakfast, cooked dinner, and then perhaps in the evening they ate supper, which might have been leftovers or bread and cheese, something like that. And this was at age 62, which was fairly advanced at the time. In the mid-19th century, male and female reformers began to look at society in a more organized and scientific way. This led eventually to useful improvements in care of the physically and mentally ill, prison reform, and public school development. Unitarians, with their dedication to equality and progress, were prominent in all these movements. The home, highly valued in the Victorian era as the province of women and the refuge of men, was one more area to organize. The scientific and the moral went hand in hand. Early experiments in sanitation, nutrition, and food purity went along with conversations on the elevation of women from household drudge. Ellen Richards, one of the founders of the domestic science movement, said, "The woman who boils potatoes year after year with no thought is a drudge. But the cook who could compute the calories of heat which a potato of given weight will yield is no drudge." It was in this mind frame that the Boston Cooking School became renowned. And in the book Perfection Salad, Laura Shapiro states, "Reformers of every sort had always found Boston a most congenial place in which to ply their theories, and for generations of women, Boston had long been a city receptive to projects representing the various stages of American feminism. Elizabeth Peabody opened the first bookstore owned by a woman there. Margaret Fuller held the first series of Conversations for Women, which were in a sense the first book club or discussion group for women in America. The daringly well-educated ladies of Boston were famous throughout the 19th century. And of course, Boston was the hotbed of Unitarianism. Women had already set up a program allowing them to take certain classes at Harvard. They were separate from men, but it was still an advantage found almost nowhere else in the United States, or indeed in the world. The Boston Reformers saw a cooking school as a force for social betterment. They started with only a couple of instructors and planned the classes for both housewives and servants. There was an offshoot on cooking for invalids, which eventually turned into modern hospital dietary services. The classes included bacteriology, psychology, and physiology. And all cooking involved chemistry. Some of you might have read a recent book or seen a TV series, Lessons in Chemistry, where a 1950s woman scientist explains to a television audience the principles behind cookery. As a result of the popularity of this and other cooking schools, women's magazines began to feature many more recipes and articles about food. One of the aims of reformers in the later 19th century was the education and assimilation of immigrants. An offshoot of the Boston Cooking School, set up in an Italian neighborhood, was very successful. But the ladies complained that immigrants resisted giving up their spicy traditions for the bland recipes on offer. And Shapiro writes, cooking school cookery emphasized every aspect of food except the notion of taste. There had been discoveries about protein and carbohydrates, but vitamins weren't yet understood. Vegetables tended to make few appearances, and of course they were only available in season unless they were home canned or pickled. Scientists at this time were fascinated to discover a young man wounded in a hunting accident whose stomach had a permanent opening. They used this opportunity to observe and record the digestion times of various foods. They assumed the best foods were those that were quickly digested, which is somewhat the opposite of what we have learned since, right? In addition to concerns about nutrition, the leaders of the cooking school put a lot of attention on the appearance of food, creating dinners that were all green or all red and white. And they tried to standardize cooking. Here's a local example. Helen Campbell, an enthusiastic social reformer in the domestic science movement, complained to an audience at the University of Wisconsin that even the intelligent housekeeper still talks about luck with her sponge cake. Luck. There is no such word in science, and to make a sponge cake is a scientific process. These reformers felt that cooking was what differentiated humans from animals. Therefore, raw foods were not to be trusted. Women were instructed to boil string beans for 3 hours, asparagus for 45 minutes, cucumber for 20, boiled cucumber seems odd in itself, celery for 30, and up to 12 hours for beets. Then the vegetables, as well as potatoes, meat, and almost everything else, was to be blanketed in white sauce. This sauce was a practical way to stretch food, but also to induce the desired uniformity and blandness. And it seems to me to have a somewhat racist undertone that white is somehow pure. For desserts, cream or whipped cream covered many fruits and cakes. This was the same attitude that later led home economists to champion mass-produced foods and to find white Crisco the perfect pure food. The few times when vegetable salads were featured, they needed to be tamed, being cut into small pieces and carefully mounded into lettuce leaves, tomato halves, or other shapes. Heaven forbid you would have a, quote, messy plate. And this is the era when many foods started to be called salads, even if they had no vegetables. Hard-boiled egg yolks mashed with mayonnaise and rolled in cottage cheese were called golf salad, so a bit like a golf ball. And this was the beginning of the gelatin era. Traditionally made at home from calves' feet, packaged gelatin was now available to purchase. The cooking school presented unflavored gelatin as a package for meats and vegetables of all kinds. And many of us remember Jell-O salads with shredded carrots and other vegetables well into the 1960s. It was at this moment that Fanny Farmer entered the Boston Cooking School. Born in 1857 near Boston, she described her family as Unitarian and bookish, promoting education for their four daughters. At the age of 16, Fanny woke up one day and fell when she tried to get out of bed. Her problem was probably a form of polio. She had no sensation in her legs, was bedridden for months, and an invalid for several years. During this time, she did help her mother with cooking in the boarding house they ran. She finally got better, but she always walked with a limp. At this point, the family felt there was no question of her getting married. And indeed, only one of the four daughters married, the others became teachers. So Fanny was working as a mother's helper, and one version of her story says that the little girl she worked with asked why measurements were so vague, and Fanny got the idea of standardizing them. Her family encouraged Fanny to attend the famous Boston Cooking School. This book, Perfection Salad, describes Fanny as energetic, red-haired, and solidly built. In contrast to her colleagues, who ignored the flavor of food, she freely described dishes as tasty, delicious, and delightful. When she finished the course, Fanny was recruited as a program assistant, and she eventually became the principal of the school. The cooking school outgrew its original location, and Miss Farmer's classes on invalid cooking led to her giving regular lectures to the fourth-year class of Harvard Medical School. but Fanny was mostly giving classes to train other teachers, which she found dull. She wanted to teach ladies or their cooks to make more complex delicacies. So in 1903, she set up her own school. Her lectures and demonstrations drew over 100 cooks a week. In 1896, while still at the Boston Cooking School, Fanny proposed the publication of a cookbook. The publisher agreed only on condition that she pay the costs. This gamble paid off, as the first 3,000 copies quickly sold out, and it has been reprinted and revised ever since. I think I have one somewhere from the 1970s. I don't know if anyone here has one or has ever had a Fanny Farmer cookbook. Fanny later published specific books on dinners, chafing dish meals, that was the in appliance of the time, daily and special occasion meals, and cooking for the sick. In Fanny's cookbook and in her classes, she called for level measurements. And she used the template we see today of listing all the ingredients first, then describing the process in detail. This wasn't necessarily standard before. And she gave simple explanations of the scientific principles behind cooking and baking. Fanny always asked herself, how can this be improved? She visited Boston restaurants with a group. They would order many different dishes. If she couldn't figure out what was in a dish, she would ask the chef for the recipe. If he refused, it was always a he, she would take home a bit of the dish to figure out back in her lab. In the later part of her 50s, Fanny again lost the use of her legs and had to lecture from a wheelchair. She worked up until her sudden death in 1915. It was diagnosed as neuritis, but was probably arteriosclerosis. Without Fanny Farmer, the movement reverted to its moralistic tendencies. Mary Peabody Mann, from a family of exceptional Unitarian women, married to the educator Horace Mann, published a book entitled Christianity in the Kitchen. She deplored rich foods. She wrote, "Compounds like wedding cake, suet plum pudding, and mock turtle soup are masses of indigestible material which never should find their way to any Christian table. It looks ominous to see a bridal party celebrating nuptials by taking poison." And of course, the poor couldn't be trusted to choose their own food, an attitude that unfortunately prevails today in some quarters. Author Laura Shapiro sums up the work of this generation thus: domestic science was the banner they carried. To change American eating habits was their only charge. And the recalcitrant nature of the American appetite was their cross. Of course, they failed in their crusade. How could they not? They chose domesticity as a way of getting out of the house and food as a means of transforming the body. They failed, but they did their damnedest. The success of the Boston Cooking School led to the introduction of cooking classes at the high school level. So one of the beliefs of education reformers was the need to train the working classes in practical skills, so the boys would learn wood and metal work, and girls cooking and sewing. Teachers who took the new cookery techniques to schools in the Black South or Indian reservations were surprised to find a lack of enthusiasm for their bland Yankee dishes. And yes, many of us here are of an era where girls took home ec and did cooking, and boys took wood shop or something else. Many women continued to see cooking as a science, and they formed professional organizations for domestic science, later called home economics. Land-grant colleges accepted them into courses like biology and chemistry. Not everyone was happy about this, and here I have another local reference. In 1907, President Charles Van Hise of the University of Wisconsin spoke to the Association of Collegiate Alumni and emphasized what he felt to be some disquieting developments. Women were beginning to equal or outnumber men in liberal arts courses, he reported, 1907, as they had done since the start of coeducation. They poured into liberal arts courses in such large numbers that men were beginning to stay away from those subjects. Only in fields like engineering and architecture were men on top. Van Hise proposed to follow up what he called natural selection by having separate classes for men and women. At the higher levels, men would study engineering, commerce, and law. The only field he thought of as natural for women was home economics. So I had no idea that this whole topic about too many women in college went back so far, making the boys look bad. For my last topic, I'd like to take a slightly different tack to talk about suffrage cookbooks. During the fight for the women's vote, the kitchen was the realm most invoked by opponents. Anti-suffrage cartoons often showed the independent woman threatening her husband with a rolling pin, or the children hungry because mother was out campaigning or voting, as if voting would take 8 hours a day. Suffrage cookbooks were not only a fundraiser, but a way to start conversations with women. The first successful example was in Washington State in 1909, and in this All Stirred Up book, the author writes, "The Washington Women's Cookbook was a central feature of that suffrage effort, to work quietly and methodically to take the suffragist message inside the homes of Washington's male voters. When Washington suffragists won that campaign in 1910, that state became the first one in the 20th century to grant women the vote. Now, some territories had women voting, for instance, Wyoming. This success started a turnaround in the suffragists' fortunes that resulted in a nationwide victory slightly less than a decade later." And the book is dedicated to the first woman who realized that half of the human race were not getting a square deal and who had the courage to voice a protest. Women around the state participated, not only by purchasing the book, but by contributing recipes. This encouraged conversations and what we would call networking. In this era, some groups created suffrage lunchrooms or cafeterias. The socialite Alva Belmont opened one in Manhattan with suffrage banners on the walls and Votes for Women China. In California in 1911, a suffrage league created picnics with prizes for the best donuts, cookies, and pies. One account reported, "The donuts were so good that crowds ate them while they listened to oratory that was evidently convincing, and they were attacked as the Donut Campaign, but they proudly took on that name." As always, some of the staunchest opponents of women's rights were women. Catherine Beecher and her sister Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote cooking and housekeeping books affirming that women's role was in the home. You might remember Phyllis Schlafly in the 1970s and 80s opposing the Equal Rights Amendment. While she traveled the country insisting that women's place was in the home, her own husband was at home cooking and taking care of their children. So that's not new. And then there's a delightful story from the time of the suffrage movement, the early 20th century, called, I'll have to look that up. Something about the pedestal. It's about the suffrage campaign in New York State. But what happens in this fictional story is that the woman says, "Oh, I can campaign and also bake biscuits." And so she bakes biscuits all day and gives them out while she's speaking. The domestic science trend helped women get scientific education and influenced the pure food movement that led to government standards championed at the turn of the 20th century by the Progressive Party. This was the time of the Muckrakers, the book The Jungle, and so on, that led to many of our reforms. Only a handful of suffrage cookbooks survive. They would have been bound simply in paper, and some were basically pamphlets. But if you're interested, there are many excerpts in this book, All Stirred Up, with modern adaptations. And also, well, all of these books feature recipes from historical times with adaptations. When women finally got the vote, food preparation was beginning to benefit from new technology, early forms of refrigeration, gas stoves, and canned foods, and a bit later, frozen foods. There were new trends in nutrition, including vegetarianism. And the advances women had made established new standards for school curricula, hospital food services, and, of course, home cooking. And I think at this point, I'd like to have a couple things. I wonder if someone would like to say something about the cookbook that Prairie did back in the 70s. I don't know if Mary Mullen or another historian or Barb Park has anything to say about that. And then also, Carlene can tell us a bit about the cookbook project that's underway now. So do we have anyone who would like to come up and talk about that?
So I think I'm chosen. Well, the cookbook that we did included multiple chapters, and each chapter had one of the Prairie artists in charge of doing the front plate, you know, where it says cookies, and then all the cookie recipes are behind. So each one had a front plate, and then throughout the chapter there were line drawings. Then there were poetry that people contributed, and comments. There were often the recipes are accompanied by a long comment. And then Lee Bullen had a printer, and he had a machine and a printing press in his basement. So he actually hand printed all of the copies, and to get them on the, very few people had computers at that time, but Dick Bonser had one of the very early computers. So everybody would go over to Dick Bonser's house, and people submitted their things in writing, and then different people would type them up on Dick Bonser's computer. So that's how it all got put together. What we did is we reprinted it again, how many years ago? About 10 years ago, because so many people didn't have the original. And so there are a few copies left of that original cookbook, or the facsimile that we did about 10 years ago. Was that?
Some of us have the original.
Yes, I still have my original, which is all stained and worn. And it's wonderful to go through it if you were around from that time, because, you know, you see all the names of the people who are, many of them, long gone. And they're wonderful they're wonderful recipes in there.
I think some people do still have family recipes, as we heard in the children's story at the beginning. One idea of the cookbook committee now was that things have changed. There are special diets now. Some people are concerned about veganism and gluten-free diets and so on. And also we have many more appliances and many more foods. Some of us never had things like zucchini and kiwi fruit when we were growing up. I think they were pretty straightforward, except for instance, a dedication like the one I read, and then what we're going to hear for our closing words came from one of those. But I think it was generally, just like church cookbooks, there are some church cookbooks do have Bible quotations, for instance, but they're generally pretty straightforward, and I think that was the idea. It was just a way to get connected and raise some funds. Thank you, everyone.